So don't feel perplexed, it's this life or the next. The things that you do return to you. The judge said Ellie and back to the stand. But all you can say to Terry is be mad. The court said Terry had the right to decide. As long as the result was homicide. Court wanted the guarantee of freedom. Guarantee of freedom to decide. Freedom in this case meant starvation. Terry had the freedom to die. It's all up to you, the things that you do, because of the people, joy or pain. The people you threw, come back for the new. The writing on the wall is quite plain. The feminist held it good, and Terry had to die. Her husband had the right to commit homicide. The feminist held it good, and Terry had to die. Her husband had the right to decide. Da 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 da. It's all up to you, the things that you do, can cause other people joy or pain. The people you screw, come back for to do. The writing on the wall is quite plain. Don't make excuses, grandma, your time is up. Your style of life was much too corrupt. You could have been kind, more forgiving and less blind. Now your time is up, your time is up.
Instead, we got war after war. Tell George Bush we won't fight anymore. heard all the lies before. Tell your torch, we won't fight anymore. Joyful singer, brave away to create world on our state. Now his son was a good hope. Robert, tell him we won't fight before. Tell yours was we won't fight anymore. We're all sick of blood and gore. Had we heard all the lies before?
I'm going to go to the next one.
Dances really sing as they watch the collapsing buildings. They clap their hands, they stomp their feet. They're dancing in the middle of the street. Dance is really dance. Dance is really dance. No, who dance at the side in the broad daylight of the Twin Towers burning? I hope you know it's so nice that the love you demo. '79, Sir Harold said America will know terror. Well, they'll strike your tallest building that in New York is standing. Dance, ladies, dance, oh, dance at the side of the broad daylight of the Twin Towers burning. Insurance plan made out of billions in his hand. Dance, really dance. Dance, really dance. Oh, dance at the side of the broad daylight of the Twin Towers burning. Israeli spies who dressed in by the FBI for treason they would never try. They danced away from all their crimes. Dance, Israelis, dance. Dance, Israelis, dance. Ooh, dance at the side in the broad daylight of the Twin Towers burning. There are no orders like the start. They work in fire and a lot of bombs. They need a plane or wrecking crew. They dance so hard, buildings never fail to. Dance, Israelis, dance. Dance, Israelis, dance. Oh, dance at the side in the broad daylight of the Twin Towers burning. Said it wasn't me, but it was a good thing for OTV. For a load of terror on that board forever was, but I on were born. Dancing is really dance. Dance, really dance. They dance at night in a pulsing light for glory and blood and everything. Israeli grave, you better make sure it's not false flag day. October 7th, people let them let a new 9/11 to save its skin. Dance, Israeli dance. Dance, Israeli dance. They dance at night in the pulsing light for joy and blood they're yearning. Turn a blind eye, we have a right, we must invent and eradicate the Palestinians. Dance, Israelis, dance.
Dance is Bailey's dance, so dance in the doors and the crows are told to the gallows in the morning. Souls, more criminals to the gallows pole.
Hello, welcome to another episode of EMJ Live. Great song, another great song by Jason Stringer. We have just had a very momentous week, and we're going to try and make sense of it today. I'm not going to do this alone. It's too much for me. I have a guest today, Father Jeffrey Langan, priest of Opus Dei. First thing we have to set the record straight. Would you please tell the world I am not a member of Opus Dei?
I can officially say that he is not a member of Opus Dei.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that issue. They wouldn't accept me if I paid them. They won't touch me with a 10-foot pole. I'm not fit for polite company. I'm certainly not fit for Opus Dei. Anyway, I wasn't here last week because I was on the road. Last week, I gave a speech in Chicago. On the way to Chicago, I saw a big pink billboard. First time I've seen this. And it said, anti-Semitism is un-American, or something to that effect. They're all over the country now. I saw them in Chicago. I saw them in Nashville.
There was one on the way here today from Chicago.
One on the way here. This is going to introduce the theme for today, which is identity. I've been talking about American identity, and now we're going to talk about Catholic identity, Catholic American identity. What does it mean? Does it mean to be an American? Do you have to fight anti-Semitism? This must mean that Henry Ford was not an American. Now, you're from Detroit. You know, I don't know what people feel now, but when I was growing up, if you ask Aldous Huxley, Henry Ford is the quintessential American. That's certainly the way he's portrayed in Brave New World. So in order to bring some clarity to this, I'm happy to have Father Langan here. And he had some insight in terms of the gospel that we've been reading lately.
Well, the gospel, because at one point Jesus, right, turns to the apostles and he says to them, who do people say that I am? And Peter, he responds as in a kind of authoritative way as the leader of the Gospels. And he says, well, some people say Elijah, some people say one of the prophets, some people say John the Baptist. And then Christ asks Peter the question, well, who do you say that I am? What I think is interesting about that is that, right, already in the life of Jesus Christ, those who are following Jesus Christ have to ask questions about their identity. And part of their identity is, what is the identity of Jesus Christ?
This is one of the most significant identity shifts in human history.
Yeah.
Where you have suddenly people who call themselves Jews are no longer Jews because they follow Jesus Christ, but now they're the children of Moses. And the people who are Jews are no longer the children of Moses.
Right.
This is precisely the moment when this happens.
When Jesus says to Zacchaeus, tonight I'm going to dine in your house, he goes into his house and then he basically calls him, salvation has now come to this house. It's come to the house of a son of Abraham. Meaning that Zacchaeus has a real identity now, which is one of the spiritual descendants of Abraham, which is a completely separate issue from the Mosaic Law, for example.
Right, right. So in the context of this week, the moment I'm giving my talk in Chicago, Candace Owens is debating Rabbi Shmuley. If you haven't seen it, you really have to watch this.
It's worth it.
I've said before, if Rabbi Shmuley didn't exist, Hitler would have to invent him to make Jews look bad. But don't take my word for it. Look at the com box under the video. I went to Nashville, met with Candace. We did an interview there, and then she was punished, basically punished for winning the debate. She was banned from YouTube, demonetized, and so on and so forth. Now, this is interesting because this is a lady who hasn't been a Catholic for a year, caught up in her identity crisis, caught up in this identity crisis, where not only do you have Vanity Fair is now doing an article about this big wave of conversions. She's the first one they talk about. And then you have First Things. First Things announces that Candace Owens does not speak for the Catholic Church. Does that mean First Things does speak for the Catholic Church? Is this a new magisterium? Just in case you don't know this, First Thing was created when Richard John Newhouse hijacked the $250,000 grant from the Bradley Foundation that was intended for the Rockford Institute. And the accomplices in this were Midge Dechter and Norman Podaris, the power couple of neoconservative political thought at that point, two Jews. And so it's been basically an organ of Jewish identity theft. Let's be honest here. The Jews pay for First Things so that they can steal the identity of Catholics, turn them into neocons or conservatives or whatever. And now the neocon Catholics are going to excommunicate Candace Owens before the water of baptism is dry on her forehead.
I think what's significant there is that, like, when Jesus asked Peter the question, "Who do you say that I am?" Peter responds and he says, "Well, you are the Christ." But Peter doesn't give yet. And of course, Peter is speaking as a representative of the apostles. He doesn't yet give the full answer. He doesn't say you are the second person of the Blessed Trinity, right?
True God and true man.
One person with two natures. He doesn't
deal with the hypostatic union.
No. But so there's faith, and eventually Peter and all the apostles profess Jesus as the one true God, and they profess him as the Christ, as the true Messiah who's come to establish a kingdom. And Jesus will eventually tell at the end of the scene, Jesus will speak to them about they will not taste death until they'll start to see the beginning of the kingdom instantiated in this world. And so what you see happening in the lives of the apostles, they themselves are coming to a deeper understanding of what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. And they themselves are coming to a deeper understanding of what is the kingdom. But you also see that whether it's people in the crowd, but there's also going to be oppositions. Well, the biblical term is opposition from the Jews to cloud that identity, to confuse that identity. And so it seems to me that this is part of the, this is one of the challenge of anybody who converts. Well, it's the challenge of every Catholic who's baptized. What is our identity as a follower of Jesus Christ, but also as a member of the kingdom? And what happens with these, what happens with Candace Owens, it happens with all the converts. I think especially this Vanity Fair article is very interesting because I know some of these converts that are listed in this article, and they're genuine converts, as far as I can tell. There's no hypocrisy there. They all lost something to become Catholic. They lost prestige of their colleagues. They were no longer accepted in polite company. And so their conversions are genuine. And they're at the same time, we all know this, that once you convert, you still have to work out the categories,
right.
And you have to shift your mind. Every Catholic has to do this. You have to shift your mind and your heart to conform your word, your thoughts and your words and your deeds to the demands of the kingdom of God.
Right. Right. I've talked about this with Jews, or Jews who have converted have talked to me. Like, because I like a corned beef special, does that mean I'm not allowed to eat that anymore because I ate it, or bagels and lox? I don't. There is a certain identity that you have to leave behind when you become a Christian. You have to leave. That's what conversion is. You have to leave it behind. And so, okay, you can still eat lox and bagels. Okay, that's fine. But if you come into the church and the first thing out of your mouth is condemning people like me as anti-Semites, that's not Catholic.
That's not a Catholic. Yeah.
That's not Christian.
No.
That's not Catholic.
We don't cast people out of the synagogue.
No, because let's take it back to Saint Peter. I mean, if Saint Peter, in a sense, he didn't get it wrong. He just didn't get the complete picture. So if Saint Peter didn't, the first pope, the rock upon the church which the church is founded, was in that situation, a man who betrayed Christ. Why are you dealing? What's your beef with Candace Owens?
Right. Right after Jesus explains, right after Peter proclaims that you are the Christ, the Son of God, then Christ explains his mission. Peter tries to stop him, saying, "No, we can't go all the way to the cross." And Jesus corrects Peter, saying, "Get behind me, Satan."
Right, strong language.
Because your way of thinking is not the ways of God, it's the ways of men.
Exactly. So you had the categories of that you brought into the church, and now you got to get rid of those categories because they don't apply anymore. This is, I'm dealing with this on a regular basis now with the race crowd. There are people, I'm trying to talk to them. You can be a German Catholic and you can be an Irish Catholic, but when you say you're a white Catholic, there's cognitive dissonance there because white is a racial ideology that is bound up with Darwinian evolution and all sorts of other mumbo jumbo that is incompatible with the church.
Right.
And there are people who don't understand it.
Well, I can say from my own experience that these last several years when I was on the East Coast at Harvard, I would meet 3, 4, 5 people a year who they grew up in some sort of good environment, but not exactly not Catholic or Protestant or Jewish necessarily. Just their parents didn't really practice any particular religion, but there came like this one fellow I'm thinking of right now got to a point where he was sitting across the street from the Republic of Chaz during 2020 in Seattle, and he realized what I'm seeing in front of me across the street, that can't be what's true. That can't be what's going to give me my identity. So he goes on to YouTube, and well, eventually the YouTube leads him to identify as a white guy. But then when he's identifying as a white guy, he comes across somebody, in this case, who's arguing against on some white guy podcast. Well, no, your identity, the essence of your identity is you are composed of body and mind and soul. And your identity comes from Jesus Christ. And Christ gave us the sacraments. And the sacramental order changes. Once you enter into the sacramental order, it changes your thoughts. I mean, it changes how you
approach. It changes the categories.
It changes how you approach all the ordinary events of life. And so, again, when I was on the East Coast, I was meeting, again, 4, 5, 6 people a year that when they were faced with either I'm white or I'm going to follow Jesus Christ, they chose the waters of baptism.
Right.
And it does. It changes your categories. It changes how you think about life.
Yeah.
I think this is part of the fear. I think the Vanity Fair article was full of fantasies. Right? I think the people they quote in that article who are the supposed experts on the Catholic Church, I think their intellectual categories are way off. But because all they're presenting are these fantasies, these fears, these creations of their imagination about what it means if the sacramental order is once again recognized and lived in some sort of public way, right? It's like the demons that say to Jesus Christ, have you come to torment us? Have you come to rule over us? Have you come to destroy us? Right? But there's a false note in that accusation.
Yeah. Well, it came up in the discussion. I mean, the people here know I'm in the middle of a book about American identity, which also means Catholic identity. And the premise of the book is that Protestantism is evaporating.
Yeah,
I think that's true, and that is causing an identity crisis among this group of people. Now, Nashville struck me as a very Protestant place. People belonging to these churches that are only flying gay flags here in South Bend, Indiana. I don't think anybody goes to them, but I think it's propelled largely by Zionist operations. I was speaking to someone there who came from the West Coast to go to Nashville because he thought it was a Christian place, an easier place to live the Christian life, joins one of these Protestant churches, and the first thing the pastor says is, well, let's go to Israel. This is the only thing that's holding these people together, you know, is defending the state of Israel. So I'm getting into troubled waters because I have conflicting identities. Am I an American or am I a Catholic? And if I'm an American, I have to accept all of these religions, you know, whether it's Scientology or whatever it is, Seventh-day Adventist, or, you know, they're all valid religions. And that's what your thing is, whatever gets you through the night, as Frank Sinatra used to say. But that's not what a Catholic would say.
No.
And so I did get into the Catholic thing, and I said that, you know, it's evaporating. And I can see there's a little bit of consternation here because these are people. These are the people that are supporting. They're supporting Candace. This is not a racial issue at all. If you see it that way, you're completely confused. Okay, the guy I was talking to was black. Everybody who came up to him in the restaurant was white. And they're all telling him, we love you. You're great. You know what I mean? That type of thing.
When I was at Harvard, the warmest reception I got almost was from an evangelical Protestant professor who was Nigerian, but grew up in New York. But for her, the racial categories didn't mean anything. But actually, what you see at Harvard is you see the practicing Christians, they're shrinking. The students that get accepted there, they're shrinking to such a level that, so for example, at the law school at Harvard, there's a genuine Bible study with evangelical Christians and Catholics led by this professor. But you also see, like in the last several years also, you see that the Catholics that want to live their faith, they're also very poorly intellectually formed. But they start to, you know, you start, we have a tradition that you can draw from to create the intellectual categories you need in order to explain things. And actually, one of the things I see happening is that I think maybe it's a good thing about maybe a place like Nashville is that some of the old walls that are preventing this healthy cross-fertilization of the Catholics with the remaining Protestants who are practicing, some of those walls are falling.
Yeah.
Which allows us to, it gives us a moment. If we can identify who we are as Catholics, it can give us a moment really to explain ourselves to them.
Yeah. So
explain the truth of the gospel.
So that brings to the next question. Who are we as Catholics?
Yeah.
Oh, we're going through an identity crisis at the moment too.
Right.
In terms of what's the neuralgic issue? What is the neuralgic issue here? You can say it here. You're among friends.
Interesting, right? Let's just describe some of the different options, right? That you have all these people quoted in the Vanity Fair article, who they purport themselves to be representatives of the church, or somehow the true interpreters of what it means to be Catholic. So therefore, they can cast aspersions on a Candace Owens, a Patrick Deneen, a Sohrab Amari, the Transformer guy, the little Transformer guy, the actor, Shia, good old Shia, right? So they present themselves as the standard. First Things presents itself as the somehow supposed standard of what is or is not acceptable as a Catholic. We were talking earlier about LifeSite News now following Cardinal Vigano and proclaiming themselves the authentic.
Right, they said that the Pope is not the legitimate Pope. Well, how did they know that?
Yeah.
They must be the magisterium.
Right.
The conclusion, it's like, how do you know that First Things, Candace Owens is not, well, because First Things said so, so they are the magisterium.
Right.
So you have all of these magisteria popping up all over the place.
This is the magisterium of polite company.
Yes.
This is the magisterium of, you somehow are not in the acceptable categories. Your thoughts are not in the acceptable categories of thought. Your categories are not the correct perceptions.
Okay, so let's cut to the chase here. The criterion of whether you can speak authoritatively about Catholic Church teaching is the number of followers you have on YouTube. Does that make sense?
And whether you're monetized.
And whether you're monetized or unmonetized.
Right.
So this means Let's trace it a little bit further. How do you get to all these followers?
YouTube and Twitter are very much. I mean, I again, this is where we're going, but
what's the how are people punished in the Gospels? How is the blind man who's cured, who refuses to denounce Jesus Christ,
he's expelled from the synagogue.
He's expelled from the synagogue. Right? The cancel culture is a category from the Jews of the Gospel.
So it's a Jewish form of punishment,
right? In other words, you exclude by somehow excluding people, depriving them of their finances, depriving them of their security, putting them at the mercy of the state,
which is exactly what would have happened to you at that time if you were expelled from the synagogue. This is exactly what happened to Spinoza. It wasn't just, oh, I can't go to the club anymore. No. It's your livelihood is threatened. You're completely isolated.
Right.
And that's the strategy that is now being applied to the media, YouTube.
It's Twitter and YouTube. It's all the social media.
So it's Jewish control.
It's a Jewish category. Yeah.
Oh, I said it. I'm sorry. I said that. Anyone who says that the Jews control the media will be condemned as a conspiracy theorist by the Jews who control the media, because that's a conspiracy theory.
Right.
It's obvious. It's on YouTube. This is precisely what has happened. Now, so I've said this before, but I'm a knight of Columbus, okay? Whether they like it or not, I know I'm an embarrassment to them, which is a fraternal organization. I rent a hall, Knights of Columbus Hall in Dallas, and the contract is violated, that's breaking the law, by Joe Sanchez, the knight. I'm on the phone with him trying to explain, well, I'm a brother knight, it doesn't matter. He went to the ADL website because it's the first thing that pops up whenever you Google my name. They guaranteed that. I'm sure it's just random. I'm sure the Jews had nothing to do with that, but that's the first thing that pops up. And that means that basically the ADL is determining whether I am a Catholic in good standing or not. Well, no wonder we're confused.
Right.
Because we don't have, this is identity theft. We don't have the ability to associate, even if it's a fraternal organization like the Knights of Columbus.
Yeah, you're saying our identity is determined by the perception of some other group, not by the sacramental order.
That's right. That's exactly right. And not just any group, but people who are our enemies.
Right.
Enemies of the people who killed Christ and are enemies of the entire human race, which is the translation which is in the Jerusalem Bible. I'm not making that up.
That's Tolkien's translation.
That's Tolkien was in on it, and he certainly knew how to talk about the English language. So we're talking about a dynamic here of an internal problem. It's not just the Catholics are suddenly super evangelists. We're not really super evangelists. But the other place where you could go to church has disappeared.
Right.
It's disappearing. You know, the Protestant church is evaporating, right. And this is causing a huge identity crisis on the part of the Protestants. So everybody's having an identity crisis. Americans, Protestants, Catholics, Europeans, everyone is having an identity crisis right now.
Yeah. Well, especially when you're going to somehow limit. It's one of the challenges of Twitter, YouTube, social media is that perception seems to be king. And if you're going to limit what identity is to a perception, then if you're going to be hyper concerned about perception. When I was in Rome, it seemed to me that the people that I knew who were in the realm of communications, especially communications with the Vatican and whatnot, one of their concerns was that there was such an obsession with perception that we could lose stating what is true about the kingdom of God, what is true about the church.
Right. This is the definition of anti-Semitism of the International Historical whatever it is society. It begins a certain anti-Semitism is a certain perception. Well, what can I do about that? Yeah. You're guilty. I can't determine what your perceptions are. You may have taken LSD 5 minutes before you showed up here. I don't know what your perceptions are. And so it can't be the basis for this reality.
Right.
Which means that the first step, I think, toward clarifying Catholic identity is going to have to be the church is going to have to come up with a definition of anti-Semitism.
Right.
Because otherwise it says in Nostra Aetate, the church opposes all forms of anti-Semitism. Well, what does that mean?
You have to define your terms.
Yeah. Obviously, they just took a term. I know what they meant. They meant biological determinism,
right?
Coming from Wilhelm Marr. But now we're in a situation where all forms, you mean everything the ADL says is we're guilty and we have to internalize the commands of our oppressors? This is just going to make a bad situation worse.
Yeah, one of my professors in Rome said that there has to be a clarification. For example, also, what do we mean by the critique of the Jews in the Gospel of John? Because there is a real critique there. There's a critique of the system, of the legal and political entity that term represents.
Hoi eudaioi is a category of reality.
It's in the Gospels.
It's in the Gospel. It's not, so if you say, it's Dave Chappelle said it, if you say the and Jews, you are immediately guilty of anti-Semitism because that is a category of your mind which exists nowhere else but in your mind. So you're like hallucinating.
Right.
Well, this is it's also, we mentioned this earlier, it's also in Walter Lippmann's book, Public Opinion. He makes a clear distinction at the beginning between categories of reality and then categories of the mind. And then it's clear their category of reality is meaningless because all we're going to do is manage perception.
It's always perception, right? Which is the sophism of the ancient world.
That's exactly. And he knew because he studied Greek.
Yeah.
He had 11 hours of Greek every week. And so he read Plato and he understood the what Thrasymachus was saying, or what Socrates was saying to Thrasymachus.
Right.
You know, Thrasymachus is saying the truth is the opinion of the powerful. That's exactly the world that we live in right now. And that is not the position of the Catholic Church. And anyone who thinks that way is not thinking like a Catholic.
Right.
And so we're constantly dealing with people who claim to be Catholic and yet are thinking completely according to categories that are alien to the Catholic faith.
Right. They're adopting the categories of the world. Right. And that's why St. Paul says, the Jews have the law, the Greeks have wisdom, we have the cross of Jesus Christ. In other words, we can't become so enamored with either the law or wisdom to a degree that we lose the essential meaning of being a Christian.
Right, right. I had a conversation with one of the conference in Kirk, nice lady, and she asked me to talk about conversion, and I tried to explain it, and then she says, so it's my way or the highway. Well, that was a category of her mind. And everything that I was trying to say about the Catholic Church had to fit through that little hole. You know, well, this is really big. You know, yeah. I got a semi-trailer load of information, and it's really going to take, and it's probably impossible to get it through that hole. So basically what you have to do is give up that category of the mind if you want to think like a Catholic. That's not easy.
No.
We're taught to think by the world around us. We have a language that we speak that naturally makes us feel that Darwinism is rational because it's English. It comes from an English-speaking world. And we have to relinquish that. We have to relinquish these categories because they're crippling us.
Right.
They're crippling our minds. They're making us incapable of dealing with reality. Now, when the church adopts this as some type of quasi-official position, that's serious.
Yeah.
That's serious. Right. We have to have a
St. Jose Maria in the late 60s, early 70s, he was saying that this is not an exact quote, but he was saying, you can see up to the highest levels of the church that they're failing to use the categories of the gospel, the perennial magisterium of the church, the tradition that comes from the fathers. If we're not using that to educate Catholics, it's going to have disastrous consequences down the road for the practice of the faith, for the life of families, and for society.
Yeah.
The church has understood this always in her teachings.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that one of those crucial moments was when John F. Kennedy got elected president. And then John Courtney Murray appears on the cover of Time magazine as if to explain to Catholics what this means.
Right.
And he reduced it to no boycotts,
which
he was referring to the Legion of Decency.
Right.
But in other words, don't impose Catholic categories on America. Impose American categories on the Catholics.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was that crucial moment.
And that's part of the fruit of Walter Lippmann's book, is how do you use Time magazine to manipulate perceptions?
Absolutely. Harry Luce read Public Opinion, yeah, and that was the basis for Time magazine.
Right.
Got backers to do it, and it was incredibly effective.
And what's funny is that when boycotts were abolished, right now you get the boycott as farce. So like last year when they did the Bud Light commercial, but they had the transvestite doing the Bud Light commercial. And then all these hillbillies, I mean, all these people throughout the country stopped drinking Bud Light, right? Which nearly destroyed the company. But it was kind of a, you know, you had people going out and shooting Bud Light.
By the way, that was a Detroit boy by the name of Kid Rock.
Kid Rock, yeah.
Okay,
who's who's also going to be interviewed by Tucker in Grand Rapids.
He shows up at every wrestling match. It's like Kid Rock, Donald Trump, and Tucker Carlson. Right, you know, right, yeah. It's like, speaking of categories, this is known as professional wrestling, and it's one of the categories that defines the mind of Donald Trump.
Yeah, and
you're gonna have to explain everything in terms of professional wrestling.
Right.
So like the conflict between China is like when Hulk Hogan comes and wrestles with Randy Savage or something like that.
Right.
This is the problem here. And we're trying to expand this, and you're constantly bumping into all of these, what should I say, prejudices. Anyway, that's our rant. Let's hear what you have to say.
Okay. Where are we at? Here we are. Okay. Hello, once again. This is Mike Pajakis. It sounds like there was some buffering issues. People had some issues with audio. Sorry about that. I do upload this on our website, the audio version, and then on BitChute. I will be fixing the audio for that. And what can you do? All right. Okay. Yeah. Mike Pajakis, Dr. Jones' assistant. Welcome to the Q&A segment of the show. Our call-ins are made via Telegram. Link is in the description. Later in the stream, read off questions from the various chats. And obviously, you guys can ask Father questions as well as Dr. Jones. Try to keep questions on subject, be respectful of time, and whatever you do, do not forget to unmute yourself. Hopefully the audio is better for Telegram. Okay, here we go. Let's go to MV. We always hear from MV. Are you there, MV?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Dr. Jones, and nice to see your special guest. You mentioned Catholic identity, and I think in terms of crisis, the most alarming example I saw was in church on Good Friday last year. There was a guy in the church wearing an Israeli Defense Forces sweatshirt on Good Friday. I'm thinking this is even sink in as to what that means. But whatever, you know, for that, I mean, that's the kind of where we are. What I don't understand is why generally, no matter what Catholic church I've been in lately, I have not heard any of the priests mention anything about what's going on in Gaza at the hands of Israel. And I know growing up in the 80s, I heard all kinds of talk about Star Wars and missiles and, you know, how we're going to end of the world and nuclear threats. They were not shy about talking about it. And now this time it's like they don't even want to acknowledge that it's happening. Just don't know if either one of you can compound on that.
Well, I think in the United, I mean, it's interesting. I was at Notre Dame for many years. And in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a very strong pro-Palestinian presence.
Father Burrell.
At Notre Dame. And they were all swept aside. They were all swept out in the late 90s, early 2000s. And so I think most Catholic priests probably in this country, probably the formation, if they're receiving any formation, it's, let's put it this way, it's not the formation of Pope Pius, St. Pius X, when he was approached about establishing a Jewish state in giving his support to a Jewish state. He said, well, no, I'll never give my support, but if you have Jews in Israel, we'll be more than happy to send missionaries there to deal with them. But I think we're at a point where I think most seminaries, most priests are being, they've probably been formed to be a little bit neocon-ish, a little bit pro-Zionist, in part because of the influence of evangelical Protestantism, which is very Zionist, right, in the 20th century. And I think probably interiorly, they're so conflicted, they don't want to say anything. So they just don't say anything. Like, better to say nothing than to say something that's contradictory.
Yeah.
Well, to any of the young theologians out there that you might know, there are young, secular, otherwise liberal people who probably are, you know, polar opposite of me on just about every other issue, who are on Instagram talking about what's going on in Gaza, reporting regularly.
Well, I can say
and
this,
I see a lot of hope in that.
When I was at Harvard last year, and the Catholics at Harvard, the undergraduate students who are several of them grew up reading Culture Wars. So we're not talking about progressive leftists here. But many of the Catholics at Harvard were very pro-Palestinian. They were sympathetic with the genocide that was going on in Gaza, right? They were sympathetic with the victims of that event. So they're more than ready, as they mature as young Catholics, they're more than ready to be kind of more fair-minded about the whole situation. They haven't showed up in public life yet.
Yeah, when Bob Sengenis got in trouble about talking about one of his books, Bishop wouldn't give him the imprimatur. He called for a meeting, and Bishop Father Massa, who was head of Catholic Jewish dialogue at the Bishops Conference, showed up, and he said, "No one believes in supersessionism anymore."
Right.
Supersessionism is the teaching of the Catholic Church.
It's clear in the Bible.
It's clear in the Bible. It's clear in the parable of the wicked husbandman and so on. So you can't escape it there. And here's a man who's saying that no one, I guess what he's referring to is no one that he knows.
No one in polite company.
No one in polite company, because that gets you excluded from polite company. He's now a bishop.
Yeah.
He's now a bishop. Well, what do you expect from the priest under him?
Right.
If you have to answer to this guy, and you're going to come out with him wearing a Palestinian flag, no, it's not going to happen.
Okay. Hope things change. Thank you both.
Okay. Thanks, MV. Who do we got next here? Lloyd, good friend. Chaboy Lloyd. Go ahead, Lloyd.
Hello, Father Jeff and Mike. I've just got a sort of comment/question around identity. I've been speaking with a lot of lay Catholics who are fairly active in the church, and what I'm finding is that their identity is basically driven by other lay Catholics, you know, the Matt Frads and all these other people. And I used to be a great follower of George Weigel till I learned what his true identity was and how he wants to send more cluster bombs to the Ukraine and all that kind of stuff. And I just think it confuses everybody, because they see Catholicism through a bunch of lay people who have lots of great people, lots of people following them, but they're not very well formed either. It's almost like a barrier between, you know, the church and them. So I'd just like you to comment on that.
I would say there's a danger of people who are working for institutes. Everyone that I know that is working seriously for an institute spends most of his time fundraising and organizing social events. And then there's also just a danger of being in the public eye, having to try to produce things all the time. I'm sure George Weigel didn't write A Witness to Hope. He had to have a team of people that were helping him to do so. Right. And so part of the danger of there's nothing wrong with wanting to be an evangelizer, wanting to try to communicate the message of the gospel to others. But I think one thing that happens with people is that they really don't have the time to research and study. Take the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. You'll hear people say, well, they've just been fighting with each other for 2,000 years. Well, no, actually, they haven't been fighting with each other for 2,000 years. Actually, before World War I, there was relative harmony between the Arabs and the Jews who were living in Jerusalem, right? So the whole conflict, it's come out of a certain political events which need to be explained. But you can only understand those events if you have the time to do a lot of research, or to find some quality individual who has done a lot of research, and that's not easy to do. So I think a lot of times these people end up saying, they end up saying superficial things, or they speak talking points which are being given to them by some faction, by some political entity, which does not have the interests of the church first in mind. So, I mean, George Weigel would be a perfect example of that, as far as I'm concerned.
You have to talk to your donors.
Right.
You can't, you know, look, I've been through this. I've been doing magazine for 44 years. Okay, and I learned early on that the best way to succeed is to tell people what they want to hear.
Exactly.
And it's no one had to tell me. You know, I knew what they wanted to hear, but I just felt like with the issue of Medjugorje, for example. You know, I had two millionaires paying my way to the Balkans, you know, and I knew what they wanted to hear, and I lost a lot of people. So that pressure is not, so when you're subjected to that pressure, the best thing you want is some big donor who's going to take away all your worries about fundraising.
Yeah.
Well, there are strings to attach to that.
Yeah.
So either you can have, you're dependent on little people, and if they get mad and leave, then you, what do I do then? Or you go to some big guy who basically is, you know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. So between those two of them, it's very difficult to find anyone who's willing to do the research, take the time to do the research, because you got the daily pressure now of producing something on your podcast every day, and following through with getting that message across to the people.
Right.
Thanks for that.
Okay, thank you, Lloyd. Let's keep going here. Kath Dad. Go ahead, Kath Dad. And don't forget to unmute on your end.
Dr. Jones, can you hear me?
I can.
Hello. I listened to your interview earlier in the week with Ms. Gemma O'Doherty, and as always, you guys have great interviews, but I couldn't help but finding myself frustrated with what I imagine some of the same parts of the conversation you were frustrated with. And I had a thought that I'd like to get some commentary on. And you can correct me if I miscategorize any of this, but it seems like some of the frustration with the quote unquote white boy crowd is in the migration. It seems like maybe an underlying fear is that, well, I don't know if I'll be able to marry and have a family with all this intermixing. And the reason I say that is because a lot of the people that seem most adamantly against, you know, like, oh, we need to keep white people together, black people together, in my experience, they tend to be people that are unmarried or don't have children. And the people that seem to have a lot more conflict with, you know, with the Catholic point of view, which you've expressed on multiple occasions, seem to be people that, I don't know. To me, it seems that there's this fear of like, oh, if all these people are mixing, I won't be able to have my own family and my own little slice of the pie. I don't know if I'm articulating that very well, but can you offer any commentary or thoughts on that?
I have a commentary. Maybe Mike has something as well, but I think it's good to just to admit, right, that if you're an Irish Catholic from Detroit, and you're going to marry a black Catholic from Alabama, you're going to have some problems. Like, what are we going to have for dinner every night? Are we going to have corned beef and cabbage, or are we going to have chitlins? And I mean, that's a real issue, because if someone who grows up in Detroit who's Irish, I mean, they're going to be used to potatoes and corned beef and cabbage. And someone who grows up in Alabama, they're going to be more used to, I hate to mischaracterize what people from Alabama eat, but they're going to be have po' boys, and they're going to have chitlins. And so there are genuine differences in culture that come from what you eat, how you dress, certain body language expectations, but those are all accidental. They're not part of the essence of what it means to be human. And I think you see it in the history of this country. There was a time when Irish could not marry Poles, and Poles could not marry Germans, and you know, and the Irish could not marry the French, even within Catholic culture. But what you see over time is that over time there's always assimilation, right? That there are people who no one has to. We're not saying anybody has to take on these difficulties, but there's always people that, well, because they have the sacraments, because they have the understanding that, well, I need to, as St. Paul says in the Ephesians, I need to learn how to love my wife, and my wife needs to learn how to respect me as the head of the family, let's say, right? In other words, we have these clear teachings from the gospel, which enable us to overcome any of the difficulties that might be involved, for example, in a marriage. So I think on the one hand, we can acknowledge that there's going to be some accidental, in any marriage, there's going to be some accidental properties, accidental difficulties that both sides have to overcome in order for the true one flesh union that's involved in a marriage. But those are by no means part of the essence of either what it means to be human or what it means to be a Catholic or what it means to be married. Right? You can't go to the church and say, I want an annulment. I married an Ethiopian, right? That wouldn't make any sense.
And I guess, Father, what I'm trying to, I totally agree with you, and I think I agree with Dr. Jones's takes as well, but I'm just trying to understand, why are Catholics struggling with this?
Well, because people, and I guess, people are forcing their categories onto us.
Yeah.
Right?
Because we
too easily adopt cat. In other words, we're running, we fear one thing and we run to something else to try to get security. Right? That's part of the thinking of the world. The world wants you to live in fear, and the world wants you to adopt a category other than the cross of Jesus Christ and the sacraments which flow from the cross. The world wants you to adopt another category by which you identify your as somehow essential to your being, to your person, right? And this is what St. Paul is dealing with the Corinthians. And this is what Jesus Christ is dealing with when he says to the apostles, right? Unless you deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me, right? You will not have any part of my kingdom. Because the word deny in the Greek, it means you have to be willing to go against certain things within yourself. You have to go against yourself. You have to go against the categories. And how I would extend that, we all have an essence. Our essence, we're made in the image of God. But the world is always going to try to give us other categories: my reputation, what it means to be in polite company, my honor, wealth, comfort. I mean, we could probably list a host of other categories. The world is always going to try to get us to incorporate one of those realities, in this case, whiteness, which is an accidental reality. But they're going to try to get us to incorporate that into part of our essence and say, somehow, I'm not going to die on the cross. I'm going to die for my whiteness. And I think that's what Christ has come to say, that these accidental realities, they're there. Yeah, there's a way we can explain them, but they don't define you as a human being or as a Christian. They're not essential to your identity.
Yeah, so Gemma, to begin with, I've been talking to Gemma for months, years now, and Ireland is under attack. That is a category of reality. There are people that, when Google took over Ireland, they wanted to basically drive the natives out and populate it with docile wage slaves and sex robots. And it turns out that a lot of these people happen to be black. Okay, as soon as a black person shows up, the other side becomes white. That was what happened in Chicago. It happened in Detroit. It happened in Philadelphia. Okay, these are not internal identities. They are external, composed on the thing. And so Gemma rightly is upset about the fact that Ireland is under attack and the natives are being driven out and they're going to be replaced by this group of people. Then she goes and flashes up a picture of Candace Owen and Lord Farmer and their two children. And she starts talking about race mixing. At this point, I had to jump in and I say, Gemma, you're barking up the wrong tree now.
Yeah.
Okay, that is not the issue. I'm mixed race. I'm Irish and German. As you know, there was a time when those people couldn't even talk to each other in America. Well, I said before, Monsignor O'Connell, when he's talking to John Ireland about taking over Catholic University, is we can't portray this as a racial issue. He meant Irish German.
Right, right. Yeah.
Okay. So what I'm saying here is the takeover of Ireland, right? That's a category of reality. That's happening. If you bring the category of the mind known as race mixing to that event, you are not going to understand anything. Yeah. And you're going to go barking up the wrong tree, and the white boys are going to rush out and they're going to burn down some building or set a bus on fire. And this will play right into the hands of Google and Varadkar and all of the lackeys that are supporting the Google takeover.
I was going to say Lewis Wirth was this sociology professor at the University of Chicago, who in the 1930s outlined the schema for how you could use the blacks, in the case of the United States, how you could use the blacks in order to destroy the Catholic neighborhoods, the ethnic neighborhoods in the North. Well, and part of his schema was he was relying on the fact that he was hoping that precisely when the blacks moved in, that it would stoke violence and animosity with the ethnic group in that neighborhood. Because he said, well, then we can exploit the situation.
Right, right.
then we can use it as a hammer. Then we can use the violence or the animosity between the two groups. We can use that as a way of coming down on the Irish or the Polish or the Germans.
Right.
And we can ethnically cleanse them.
That's right. And that's exactly what happened in Detroit. That's right. And so as soon as you establish racial categories, they will create conflict. because there's nothing I can do about my right. DNA, and there's nothing that other guy can do about his DNA. And if it comes down to a fight, well, we have to have a fight. That's why it's important to talk, to be Catholic and talk about Logos, because you can talk to these people, which happens naturally. Nashville was full of black and white people talking to each other. Okay, I think we, unlike Gemma, is Ireland doesn't have any experience with. And she started talking about the United States, started talking about Africa. You know, I think we're fairly successful in bringing about racial harmony in America, and would have been really successful if it weren't for the Jews who created the civil rights movement and been weaponizing it ever since.
Right.
The main supporter of Black Lives Matter was George Soros. He gave him $23 million to create this type of conflict, because divide et impera, when you divide, you conquer.
Right. It's always been the way of empires to want to radicalize individual groups to keep them at odds with each other.
Right.
So that they don't look at the empire, and they don't look at the who's.
So I could have, if we could have talked to the black folk in Philadelphia, we may have been able to say, well, it's the Ford Foundation. It's Leon Sullivan. Why are they doing this? Why are they pitting each other? But those conversations couldn't take place because I hadn't written the damn book
right,
yet.
That's right.
Yeah, I hadn't written Slaughter of Cities. Now that we have Slaughter of Cities, we should not fall into this trap, because I exposed the whole plan.
Right.
Well, thank you both for your takes. And I just hope Catholics continue to make the right distinctions and don't get caught up in these racial categories. So thank you for your work and trying to just continue to distinguish those.
Thanks for being a Catholic dad.
I love it.
All right. It's about 5:55. Did you want to keep doing questions?
Yeah, well, let's do some more questions. We took up a special podcast. If we have other questions, let's do some more questions.
Yeah, let's do some more. Next was a Chicago talk show host. Are you there?
Hey, everybody, can you hear me?
Hey, I just moved to Chicago. I hope we get to meet.
That would be great. I want to say thank you, Father Langman. Thank you, EMJ, for another great show. And I want to pitch in this to the conversation. Consciousness is also expanding about the grand political theater we all have to endure. And this is best represented just this week with Representative Thomas Massie recently calling out the political theater, saying, quote, on X, "I refuse to be a part of this thespian show and this speaker's failure theater." I kind of ruined that. But this open acknowledgement that we're all just seeing this political theater, where do we go from here? Thank you very much.
Oh, you pull back the curtain. That's what consciousness is. You expose. This is. I know Socrates got in trouble for this.
Yeah.
But basically, you have to say, well, there's a higher good than the idols of the state, and especially in an empire. I mean, a republic can be virtuous. An empire is always a criminal conspiracy, and so it's our duty to expose.
Right.
Pull back the curtain, expose the man behind the curtain who's pulling the levers. We know that.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think also it seems to me that one of the good features of YouTube or of X, let's just say X at this point, Twitter, is that there's an incredible, you said it, there's an incredible change of consciousness between 2010 and now, especially among ordinary people, right? That I mean, I think it's quite impressive. All the memes that are produced whenever anything happens, all the memes that came out after the presidential debate this week, right? And you see that people are attentive. They're aware in ways that they were not, right? In the 1980s, there were three networks and they all gave us the same line. And everybody, like on the day that JFK was shot, Walter Cronkite says it's a lone gunman, and that's everybody accepts that story for 40 years. Well, how many things have happened between April and now that individual researchers like you have debunked what the first statement that was supposedly explaining the situation? So I think there's a great, and this was in a sense you might say the genius of Socrates. Socrates knew, and all the dialogues of Plato are interesting. Because in the middle of the culture of the sophists that was dominating the Athenian Empire, Socrates is able to enter into conversations with all of these different that's the dialogues of Plato. He enters into conversation with all these different characters in order to expose their fallacies, in order to question their misunderstanding of things, to try to start to get to the truth that man and that the soul are essential to understanding human society. And Socrates understood that there's a huge cultural war that's going on for the soul of Athens. And it's going to determine whether we just fight wars for the next 400 years or whether we somehow are committed to the transformation of our souls for the next 300 or 400 years. And one of the interesting things, of course, is that ultimately Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, they lost that cultural battle to the sophists. The sophistry became the operating system of the Greek Empire, and then after that, the Roman Empire, and it remained. Even Augustine, Saint Augustine, was the best sophist in the Roman Empire. He was known as the best sophist of the Roman Empire. The educational system of sophistry essentially dominated until the Christians took over the Roman Empire. There's always a host of problems, but essentially, I think what Twitter enables us to do. And Christianity, in a way, is always a very popular, populist enterprise because, well, for example, in the Roman Empire, the Christians, under the threat of persecution, they became the majority, right? They eventually just, not through force, but they just became, the message was so attractive and the way it was taught was compelling, such that so many people embraced the sacraments. So in a way, I think it can give us this opportunity. But just like with the first Christians, we're just pointing out there's all sorts of dangers out there. There's innumerable potential factions that we could potentially fall into. And part of, I think, what we're trying to do is we're trying to basically help people to understand or help people to come to the awareness of, right? Don't be fooled so easily, right? Don't understand the tricks, understand the ways that you could start to deviate from the way. Right? Our Lord says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And there's all sorts of ways you can deviate from the way. So we play this great role, but you see it happening, right? Where people are becoming savvier in a way to all the tricks that could be used against them. So.
Still there, Chicago? I think he's good.
I appreciate that. That was very eloquent and immersive. Thank you both.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for that question. Keep going here, guys.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go. Alejandro Herrera. Are you there, Alejandro?
Hello.
Hello.
Greetings to you both. I wanted to ask for a kind of practical advice. I live in Mexico, and Dr. Alfredo Jalife has, he's saying that Mexico is trapped in a geopolitical cage, as many other places in the world, and especially with the U.S., because our main incomes in the whole country is the money that the people from the U.S. send to Mexico, and also the agreements, the commercial agreements, like the NAFTA, and now I believe it's called TEMEC. Is there an advice, like, for as practical as it could be for the common people in Mexico? Thank you.
Don't buy Monsanto corn. I mean, I think your previous political policy, I think they were trying to make themselves a little bit more independent from the empire. I think anything that leads to a kind of independence from the empire will lead to freedom for the church. And I think also in Mexico, right? In most Latin American countries, the American empire has instituted, under the guise of religion, has instituted all sorts of projects to undermine the Catholic Church in those countries, because they understand that Catholic identity is essential to any identity that's going to be outside of the American empire. So other than like food freedom, like don't buy Monsanto corn, make your own corn and reestablish, right, a good agricultural economy in Mexico, things like that. But I think most importantly, obviously, is the freedom of the church, the freedom of the church to operate, the freedom of the church to be able to articulate her message, to get people into the sacraments, and I think especially in Mexico, to educate them what it means to be a Catholic, right, to what it means to what the sacraments mean, and what it means to live a consequence of the sacraments in your life, in all the dimensions of your life. There's a Mexicans have told me this, so I'm not saying this as an outsider, but the Mexicans, the priests that I know in Mexico will say to me that the church is wide in Mexico, but it's not deep, right? Whereas the church in the United States, actually a lot of the Catholics, they do very well. They do understand on some level the beginnings of what it means to be involved in the sacraments and the consequences that has for our lives. And so I think in Mexico, it's extremely important that you acquire a deep formation of your Catholic, of the Catholic faith, of the principles of Catholic social teaching, and then how that applies in your country. And that will enable the freedom of the church, both as a church, but also from the empire, the whole state from the empire.
Yeah, the great exodus of Mexicans to the United States began when the country was flooded with cheap corn. And it basically put the local providers, local agriculture, out of business because it undercut their price. That's the way the empire works. The British Empire loved free trade because they would come in and they'd undercut everyone's prices. They'd drive out domestic production, and then they had a monopoly. Cloth, cotton cloth was the main weapon. That's why Gandhi carried around a little spinning wheel, because he needed to establish independence. It's the same issue in Africa right now, except there it's more with clothing. They are importing cheap used T-shirts. 20-ton ball rolls off the ship in Mombasa every day, broken up, and it goes all over Kenya, and it's in the market. It's called Mutumba. It's a Swahili word for used clothing, and it has destroyed cotton production. So what you have to understand is a kind of paradox. The lowest price is not the best price. If someone comes to your door and says, I'll give you this apple for free if you cut down your apple tree, don't do it, because there's a plot there.
Right.
You know what I mean? Your apple tree is much more valuable than a million apples, because they'd all rot anyway, and the tree will produce them regularly. So don't cut down the tree because your guy's going to give you free apples.
Well, thank you very much. Greetings and God bless you.
All right. Did you want to jump to
Let's go to the written.
Yeah, because we had a lot. There's a bunch for Father as well.
Okay, let's go to the written comments.
Speed round.
All right, here we go. On let's see, do I got everything figured out here? Yeah. All right. On Rumble, from AG DeVille, question for Father. Is Catholic Charities doing God's work by facilitating illegal immigration into the U.S.?
When I was in Rome, the priest I knew who worked in the State Department of the Vatican said to me that Catholic Charities is a perennial thorn in the side of the Catholic Church. And I think what he meant by that is that the Catholic Charities is not, they're always involved in political endeavors, from this and endeavors always oftentimes coming from the standards of the world, and so they're going to be prone to doing things that are just going to be going along with someone's political agenda,
especially if money's involved.
Well, and money's always involved, right? So Catholic, it's always been difficult for the church to rein in Catholic Charities. I think you see actually the Catholic bishops in this country trying to do some things to rein in Catholic Charities. But it's an ambivalent relationship. Because I don't think the people that are involved in helping Catholic Charities, I don't think they're aware, I don't think they're even willing to consider the way that immigration can be used as a weapon. And that's obviously what we're concerned about here. On the other hand, offering hospitality to the foreigner or to the traveler, it's one of the works of mercy, And in fact, to not offer hospitality is a sin that cries out to heaven for vengeance. Now, that doesn't justify an institutionalized response or an institutionalized promotion of the weaponization of immigration.
Putting people in there in that situation in the first place.
Right.
Is.
But so you need to kind of you need to understand the institution, but then you also need to understand, well, what is the church's teaching, which comes from the Gospels on this.
All right. On Cozy, next question from Veritasity. Was it true that Malachi Martin was ethnically Jewish?
He never
admitted to it if he was.
First of all, even if he were, it doesn't matter because
he was baptized.
I assume he was baptized. Otherwise, you can't become a priest without being baptized. Has Vatican II changed that?
No.
So he was a priest, so therefore he was baptized, so therefore he was no longer a Jew. So what difference does it make what his DNA was? It's an irrelevant question.
If he made mistakes, it was because he made mistakes as anybody could, especially anybody who's an agent could.
That being said, he was a subversive, a double agent during the Second Vatican Council. And if you want to read the full story, buy a copy of The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. Read that chapter.
Okay. Next question. This is from Paulette's Mind. Question for Father. When the Haitian slaves revolted and killed all the white people, did that allow some kind of demonic influence? And could they still be under the demonic influence today with voodoo, etc.?
Well, clearly with voodoo. I mean, voodoo is trading in spirits. I mean, it's a pagan religion. And the problem is that there's this kind of syncretism, right? There's this mixing together of Catholic elements with the pagan practices, like the sacrifice of animals. Like the eating of cats and dogs, right? No, so I mean, I don't mean to make a joke out of it, but no, so there's clearly problems that are demonic in nature that go back to the foundations of voodooism. So you have to be wary of it. And I think it's one of the sad things about the history of Haiti is that it's never been able to like stand on its own two feet. And even in most recent times, again, Haiti's become a kind of demonic playground of the empire as well. So they're also suffering from the effects of programs that we've imposed on them as well. It's not just that they're victims in this, but they also have problems of just being under demonic influences. Yes.
Have you heard about this mural at the Port-au-Prince airport of some type of demonic consecration of the island?
I have heard of that.
I don't know the details. I've never been to the airport in Port-au-Prince, so I can't say firsthand, but I've heard that. Someone asked me, like, how can you explain a Catholic country like Haiti being so backward if Catholicism is such a good religion? And I said, well, is voodoo Catholicism?
Right, yeah.
No, it's not. It's the opposite.
Yeah, and also you have the whole problem that, again, the independence of Haiti is, it's inspired by the ideals of the French Revolution, which was an anti-Catholic revolution from its beginning. So this is part of the problem of Europe and of many of the colonies of Latin America, that you have this mixture of the pagan culture, the church trying to evangelize, but then also the anti-Catholic various modern cultures that come out of the Enlightenment. So it's always going to be a complicated mess.
Yeah, Pierre Toussaint went to escape from Haiti, ended up being a hairdresser in New York, and I think he's on the way to sainthood or something or other. But anyway, he talked about the horrible things he saw when the revolution took place.
Right.
And the revolution in Haiti became then the paradigm that the Jews tried to apply on the South. They were always trying to foment a Haiti in the southern states of the United States.
Right.
Okay, on that question of revolution, I guess, good follow-up here from Free Gaza. What does Father think of Franco's Spain versus current secular Spain?
Well, I mean, Franco, throughout the history of the world, there's the example of the dictator who is the only one that is capable of bringing a country out of chaos. And so it seems like I mean, Frank, Spain ended up in a, this is very superficial, but Spain was in a civil war in the 1930s, and there were all sorts of, there was 30 some factions coming out of this civil war. Franco did what he could. He established a dictatorship with all of the good and the bad that come with the dictatorship. But in some sense, if you're going to bring about an end to chaos, right, you need a strong hand in order to end the chaos. The difficulty is, at some point, you need to change the laws to go back to an ordinary society, right? When Cincinnatus becomes the dictator, you might say in Rome at one point, but eventually he goes back to his farm. And this was the problem that Franco faced. He faced the difficulty of how do I, you know, once I've established this relative harmony, right, how do I open up the society again? And right as he was opening up the society again, the Harvard Business School stepped in, and the Americans stepped in, and they greatly complicated how the society would make this transformation from, and let's face it, I mean, obviously everyone in Spain was a baptized Catholic. So the Catholics themselves, they began to become, just outside groups were able to also influence them such that chaos breaks out. Chaos breaks out. A new kind of moral chaos.
Is that an example of the failure of Dignitatis Humanae? Do they have de facto separation of church and state in Spain now? I don't know.
Not really. Well, what you have in Spain now is what you have in so many European countries in the 19th and 20th century, where the government is taking a hostile position against the church, against Catholic institutions.
Right.
So it's more of just raw anti-Catholicism. Yeah. But it's certainly not Dignitatis Humanae.
No, I mean, could Dignitatis Humanae have rescued the situation?
No.
Okay.
If anything, Dignitatis Humanae, those ideals probably exacerbated the situation.
Yeah, I can see a misinterpretation of that leading to the separation of church and state. Because John Courtney Murray wrote the notes to it, and that's pretty much what he said.
I mean, like one small thing is that in the United States, I mean, this is just a small thing, but as far as the practice of Catholic education, if we Catholics want to, we can still have single-sex education. Well, the government of Spain now, in the interest of religious freedom, basically prohibits Catholic education or single sex education. So all the single sex schools have to go co-ed.
Yeah. We did it to ourselves.
Notre
Dame, classic example.
Yeah. But there are still cities in this country where you, like St. Louis, Detroit, still have some of the single sex schools.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Next question here from Neil PM Seed. Question for you both. What would it take for RFK Jr. to remember his Catholic identity and the categories of reality he has direct experience of? Thank you.
He has to go to confession. I've been trying to get him to go to confession, but I don't know if it's worked. He has to go to confession, right? He shows all the marks. I went to his, I went to the speech he gave in Boston where he announced he was going to run for the presidency. And it became clear to me just walking around talking with people there, but also just listening to the speech that he gave. I mean, his public life is well known. He tells the story of his life. He's the classic guy that grows up in the 1960s, 1950s and 60s. His father had a kind of weird understanding of how do you reconcile faith and reason. His father had him read Albert Camus, which was like, I think, very typical among the East Coast elite at that time. Being open to, we can be open to everything. We can be open to existentialism. We can be open to everything. But then his father had a kind of non-intellectual practice of the faith, went to daily mass, was kind of strict. But intellectually, it seemed like in many ways, intellectually, it didn't seep over. And so when his father is assassinated, he becomes an addict. And then at that point, the trajectory of the addiction follows. And so what many addicts do when they recover, and at least humanly, this is worth something, right? They adopt the 12-step programs and whatnot, which gets them off the drugs or off the alcohol or whatever. But that creates a kind of harmony between the body and the mind, but we're composed of body, mind, and spirit. St. Paul says, don't be psychikos. Don't be just psychikos. Don't be just people of the body and the mind. You have to be pneumatic also. You have a spirit, right? It's your spirit that's recreated when you're baptized. And the whole goal of life is, how do I bring my body, my desires, my emotions, my passions, how do I bring all of that into harmony with the way that I've been regenerated, recreated in baptism? And if that's been wounded in some way because of personal sin, I need the sacrament of confession. I need to regenerate my spirit through the sacrament of confession. And he just strikes me as, again, this is just listening to a speech that he gave, but it just strikes me that he's like the class. I've seen many people involved in addiction recovery who are like this, where they get that they have to bring some order to their lives. They use the procedures that are given to them to bring some order to their lives, but there's the sacramental wall, and they need to reunite themselves with Jesus Christ through the sacraments. And the way for him to do that as a baptized Catholic is through the sacrament of confession.
He is totally intellectually unprepared to run for president.
Right.
He got one issue right, which is the vaccines. That's really too narrow an issue for what he says. The most recent example of his incompetence is attacking Candace Owen and saying, my father had a picture taken with the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah, Menachem Schneerson. And so therefore, I support Rabbi Shmuley. It's totally out of touch.
Yeah, the intellectual category.
Totally out of, this is exactly the theme of our program here,
yeah.
Is if you want to really be a Catholic, you have to think like a Catholic, because right. We are thinking beings. And if you have totally alien categories, or if you spent, you know, a significant period of your life taking drugs and having sex with as many women as you could, you didn't learn things that you need to know.
Yeah.
You need to learn these things, and you have to make an effort, and the grace of the sacrament will help you to do this. Which brings up another question, is basically, can you have a successful life without grace, without supernatural grace? Can you have a successful life?
No.
I don't think you can.
You cannot have a fulfilled life, no.
I don't think you can't do it on your own. So this is what, I think I got into this with the Iranian lady. I think I just emphasized Logos so much that she got the impression you could think your way into heaven.
No.
It's not a philosophical thing.
The Matthias Schieben has a, anybody wants to do some reading on this, Matthias Schieben, Nature and Grace. It was written in the 19th century, but it's still very relevant today. You need grace to fulfill your mission as a human. And grace also makes you capable of doing much more than you think you're capable of.
Yeah. Thinking your way into heaven is known.
But it's not.
It's known as Platonism. And Augustine was the guy who wanted to become a Platonist.
Right.
The otium liberale. He's going to retire from the world. He's going to contemplate the higher things. He's going to rise up to the realm of forms. Well, it didn't work.
Yeah.
It didn't work. And it didn't have to work anymore because Jesus Christ came down. This is the whole point of the incarnation, is that he came down so you didn't have to think your way into heaven.
All right, next question. Veritasity asks, was Saint Joseph, Jose Maria, aware of the Jewish threat in the church?
Yes.
How so? He just knew?
Well, I mean, he knew of the groups. I mean, he knew of the groups that were trying to influence, for example, the Second Vatican Council, and he opposed them. And he also understood the damage that would be done if their influence became internal to the church and its teachings and its practices.
Next, from Steranius 56, Pope Francis' recent comments regarding all faiths having salvation. What do you guys think?
First of all, I'm not sure he said that. I'm not sure he said that they were salvific. I think he said that faiths
are paths.
Our path to God. So obviously, if it's a faith, if it's a religion, you're obviously trying to approach God.
Right.
And I've said this before about the Muslims. The Muslims are sincere in their worship of God. They're sincere in their belief in God. They worship the same God we do, but they do not belong to a salvific religion.
There are seeds of the gospel that are in almost anything that's human, you could say that there are seeds of the gospel, that if those seeds were cultivated properly with the help of grace, they could be graces that are leading that person to accept the Jesus Christ as Savior and to join the Catholic Church. And so there's a lot of people probably around the Pope, and the Pope himself probably really wants to give a kind of emphasis to what language can we use in order to, well, start a dialogue with people so that we can start to find out what are those seeds of the gospel that are in what their thought or in their practices or in their lives, and how can we cultivate those seeds to lead them to the truth of salvation, to the truth of Jesus Christ.
Okay, next question from Pullet's Mind. Dr. Jones, how should a good American Catholic respond when he sees an immigrant killing a duck in a park or a cat walking by and taking them home to eat?
Make a crazy video.
I think you should give him ketchup. Wait a minute, let me take that back. If it's a goose, applaud the guy. We have so many geese.
Too many
here.
Canadian geese.
I think it would be a. We should import Haitians just to get rid of the geese here. That's my feeling.
Goose, give him some plum pudding or some plum jelly to help the meat go down.
I say this from personal experience. When I get into the dock to do my 5-mile piece on the river, I have to put my hand down the dock. How many times have I put it into goose poop? Believe me, this would be a big improvement if we have fewer geese in the United States. And as far as cats go, I think they're worse than geese. I don't want to offend anybody here. I know you like cats, but that's my feeling.
Probably or just make a song out of it, put it on TikTok, make a meme out of it. Just have fun.
Okay.
I gotta go, actually.
Let's see.
All right, we got one more question.
One more. All right, I had one somewhere here. Where was it? I did have one. The scrolls kept scrolling. I don't know if this person was serious with this question. Maybe they just want to know. I guess it's for Father. From Fagapon on Rumble. Can we take breaks from being Catholic during ordinary time, since it's just ordinary and not sacred?
No, not at all. Not at all.
That'd be nice, but
No. Yeah.
All right. All right, everybody. Thanks again. This has been EMJ Live. We're here every Friday at 5, unless Dr. Jones is out of town, of course. If you're not already, subscribe to Culture Wars magazine only at culturewars.com. And Dr. Jones' books can only be bought at fidelitypress.org. Subscribe to Telegram, Rumble, Gab, BitChute, Twitter. I'll fix the auto for you guys if you guys probably like that, and I'll put that on our website early next week. Any last words from anybody here?
God bless America.
God bless America.
See you guys next week.
All right, thanks.